You are listening to the Tricorder Transmissions, episode 59. And
now,
here are
Craig
and
Jeff.
Welcome back to the Tricorder Transmissions. We are here for episode 59, and the children shall lead.
All right. So, Jeff, it might not be obvious to our listeners, but we actually took some time off from a recording because you had a vacation to go on. So how about instead of covering a lot of news today, you want to just jump right into the episode?
Sure. And the children shall lead first aired on October 11th of 1968, and the remaster came on April 14th. Of 2007.
All right, and for a plot rundown, a group of children on the Federation outpost Triacus, under the influence of an evil spirit, commandeer the Enterprise.
All right, we're going to start our commentary in 3, 2, 1.
Ah, there we go.
Yeah, familiar. I like how this episode has a score
of its own.
So we're hearing a lot of episodes that have their own scores. So far.
You know what? It's not pointed out until a couple of minutes into the episode, but is it kind of amazing that there's planets that are completely uninhabited? I mean, in the universe where we have the Star Trek universe, where there's alien races.
I guess, but I mean, yeah. In reality, we have plenty of them here, but
yeah, it just seems like in that future, the Federation of Planets would have started setting up, you know, colonies, or I don't know. It just seems, maybe it's me looking at it from, you know, our time period's perspective in terms of the fact that natural resources are becoming scarce, and it just seems like whole planets that can sustain human life apparently.
Yeah, I don't know if this can sustain human life. I'm pretty sure they had to have some kind of supplies flown in.
Well, yeah.
That looks pretty barren.
It's got an atmosphere you can breathe, which I think...
Great place to raise kids, too, apparently.
Yeah, it's the most... being able to breathe the atmosphere is probably the most important thing.
Oh, that's great.
yeah. So this is a pretty terrifying situation they beam down to.
It is, and I have to say that I'm kind of relieved that they're wearing some of the leftover jumpsuits from Devil in the Dark. Makes me feel a little bit better about the terrifying situation.
Ah, you know what? I didn't pick up on that, but I know that it's one of your favorites, so
yes.
Of course your eye would catch that.
So a little connection there with
one of very cool.
My favorites. But so we've got a mass suicide, apparently.
Yeah, yeah. And it was somebody down there, the last person alive, knew... Or Kirk knew who he was, but he didn't know who Kirk was.
Right. So that was another. That was an interesting thing that I was wondering. Is like, does everybody in the universe know Kirk? It seems like every time you go to a planet and there's people there, like it's me, it's Kirk.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, it's another interesting thing about this episode, and that there's a young man named Brian Tochi here.
Yes.
And he's just on screen, and he's one of very few children that starred in a Star Trek episode that came back later as an adult to be cast. Actually, it was cast in a Next Generation fourth season episode called Night Terrors, and he played Ensign Kenny Lynn.
Yeah, but more importantly, and I didn't realize it till I sat down to watch this episode, he played Takashi in Revenge of the Nerds.
Get out!
Yes.
Nice.
And he also, he does a lot of voice work now, and he did the voice of Leonardo in the three Ninja Turtle movies from, I guess, the late 80s and early 90s, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, The Secret of the Ooze, and then I think part three, the one where they go back in time to Japan.
Wow, that's pretty cool. He's had quite a little fruitful career.
Yeah, and it seems like now, in addition to his voice acting, he's also doing a lot of charity work involving, trying to find sustainable environments for people in third world countries.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, but there's a couple of the actors here, child actors that went on to do some other stuff, and I guess when we find a spot to talk about it, we will. But one thing that I thought was interesting here is we have in season three two first timers in terms of behind the scenes work on Star Trek, namely director Marvin Chomsky, born 1929, who directed three season three episodes. He also directed The Wild Wild West, Gunsmoke, Mission Impossible, and an episode of Roots. And we'll also see him next on Day of the Dove. And then the writer, Edward J. Lasko, who died in 2009 at the age of 76, wrote for The Mod Squad, Mission Impossible, Mannix, the Planet of the Apes TV show, wow. Starsky and Hutch, and over 30 episodes of Charlie's Angels he wrote.
Good Lord.
Yeah, but, you know, we're seeing two first-timers here, which I didn't go back and look, but I think a lot of the directors had multiple episodes, but this is the first time that there were two brand new folks to the series.
Yeah, and the first time we're seeing the United Federation of Planets flag.
Yeah, which I thought was pretty neat. And the McCoy is instantly sort of concerned that here they are burying these kids' parents, and they seem oblivious to the fact that they're all dead.
Yep, yep, yep. Strange behavior indeed.
Yeah.
And we'll find out a little bit more, but one more first to wedge in there. One more first to wedge in there, and this is the first use of that cave that we saw in the background. That little cave set will make a few more appearances. This is the first one. It'll also... Oh, actually, you know what? And it was also in Spock's brain. Sorry, this is the second appearance. It'll also be in the Cloud Miners, All Our Yesterdays, and That Which Survives.
Ah, so a little creative use or reuse of sets on the budget strap season three.
Yeah, I thought that this set overall was a little bit stark and barren, and I was thinking to myself that it was a little bit strange that the parents are all kind of just dead, littered around on these rocks, and wouldn't you think you'd see some kind of a settlement there? Wouldn't they be, you know, in some tents or something nearby there? They're just kind of in the middle of nothing.
Yeah.
So I don't think we actually see any sort of settlement until way at the end of the episode when we're watching some video clips of the parents and the kids playing. You finally see some things in the background. But there's a lot of scenes like this, and you'll see a couple scenes and a little bit up on the ship of some log entries where, once again, there's no housing or anything apparent there.
Yeah.
But the kids all strangely have the same boots.
Yeah. I did notice that. I guess that's the Federation-issued children's footwear.
Yeah, even the little girl wears the same boots as the boys do. Fascinating.
Yeah, and speaking of fascinating, it seems like until this moment, Spock really doesn't say much in this opening sequence, which it stood out to me for some reason.
It was mostly McCoy and Kirk at first, and then Spock actually stands corrected here. He actually almost admits to being incorrect about something.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. So they're kind of trying to figure out what's going on here, and of course, and Spock has a lot of interesting theories about what could be going on, but he's actually winds up being correct.
Yeah.
That there's an outside force that caused all of these adults to commit suicide. And I guess we'll see a little bit more of that as we get introduced to the alien villain in this movie. But we've already been introduced to that alien villain's real-life son, Caesar. And he plays the little kid, Steve. That's Melvin Belli, Gorgon's son. Yeah.
I didn't catch that when I was doing my my prep for this.
Yeah, Caesar Belli. I think he's the little kid with the bowl cut.
Oh, okay.
I'm pretty sure. I think he's the kid who gets upset about his ice cream in a little bit.
Which it's funny, Melvin Belli was married 6 times.
Wow.
So I'd imagine he was born in 1908, so old Melvin was in his 60s at this point and has it looks like a 10-year-old child, so it looks like he was getting out and about, if you will.
Well, hey, you know, he's getting his swerve on even later in life. Good on him. Good on him. So I like that McCoy actually is a psychologist in this episode, as well as a surgeon and a general doctor.
Yeah.
So he's pretty much an all-around everything as far as medical needs.
Yeah.
So if you have any sort of depression or mental trauma, McCoy's your man, just as he would be if you got a bullet wound or a phaser shot or some sort of disease. He can do anything and everything.
Yeah, I wonder how much schooling he had.
Yeah, unbelievable. You know, I start to wonder, though, with all the technology they have, how much schooling does he really need?
Yeah, right. Just turn on a your tricorder.
Yeah, like eventually it's like IKEA. You just kind of follow the little picture directions and put somebody back together. I love Shatner's acting in this scene. He switches into this anxiety mode, and you instantly see a change in him. I love the way he does this. In stark contrast to the overacting he does a little bit later in the Turbo Lift scene.
Yeah.
But I like this. This is a really good example of Shatner's acting. He runs outside to get away from it.
Yeah.
And immediately feels relief. And you can see him switch back into regular Kirk.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. That's great stuff.
Which, yeah, this scene sort of had me on the, you know, trying to figure things out in terms of why Spock would be immune to that feeling. Because at this point, we're not really sure what's affecting the people on that planet and why the kids are immune. But I you know, as I'm trying to piece the mystery together, I was thinking, oh, well, somehow Spock's immune, which we would later learn isn't. And here it's really funny. So we have Nurse Chapel getting these ice creams for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got a card that creates the different flavors.
Yes.
And we have the kid that chooses for a surprise, and then he doesn't like his surprise. And he asks for a really odd flavor, like peaches and watermelon or something. And then he adds a third flavor at the last minute. And Chapel has a card for it.
Yep. There's a card for everything. Yeah, this is Steve. This is Belli's son. Coconut and vanilla, they're both white.
Yeah.
What an unpleasant surprise, both colors being white are.
Yeah.
This is Nurse Chapel teaching him a lesson. But jumping back for a second to your Spock not being affected, I was just thinking about it. I'm wondering, maybe he really is affected, but since he doesn't have emotions, he doesn't know how to process it, or it doesn't manifest in him the same way it does in Kirk.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah. So here's that really weird ice cream combination. I think it was pistachio and some kind of fudge marble and marble peach.
And peach, yeah.
All in one bowl.
Yeah. But Chapel had the recipe, if you will, for it to stick into the replicator.
Yeah, and it's funny that you, in the past, all you had to do was say what you wanted into the replicator. And this one, you need a specific tape to get a specific flavor.
Yeah.
You know, I hearken back to the chicken sandwich and coffee, coffee incident. Or with the dribble in the cup.
Yeah.
But very interesting that how the technology changes. Mm-hmm.
So we have McCoy here indicating that, you know, Kirk wants to question the kids. And McCoy's concerned because the kids haven't really processed what happened yet.
More and, psychology.
Yeah. And until they have, he's really, really concerned. But I got to say that this sequence here shows another great ability that Shatner had.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think this is an extension of his normal personality here, and it's probably his experience as being a father himself. But his interaction with the kids here is great. And you'd like to think that a starship captain would be able to relate to people on this level in terms of, you know, sort of dialing it down a little bit, cheering up a little bit, and really, you know, it's akin to getting down on your knees to talk to a kid, you know, at right. their level.
Yeah, he shifts gears.
Mm-hmm.
So he's able to be, you know, Papa Kirk when he needs to.
Yeah.
And he can still be the stern commander when he needs to, and the empathetic friend when he needs to. It's great that he's able to really, you know, get down on the kid's level and start to talk to them. But he starts to get a little too parent, a little too parental here.
Yeah.
A little too fatherly, and he starts to cheese the kids off by asking them questions about their parents. And they start to run around in this atrium set, which we haven't seen before. Interestingly enough, this atrium scene was designed for Elan of Troyes, but would wind up being a deleted scene in that episode.
Oh, okay.
So this is the first time we would see it on set. So pretty cool.
Yeah.
And we get another. So even in the budget-strapped third season, we still get some new stuff.
Yeah. And you can assume that this is possibly a place where Sulu hung out to do some of his botany.
Yeah, wouldn't you think Gertrude would be hanging around in here somewhere?
Yeah, missed opportunity.
Yeah, that would be cool. They brought Gertrude back. Oh, well. We'll have to go to the Red Shirt Diaries for that one.
Yeah, yeah.
So I like the undertones here that the kids are frustrated because their parents didn't spend a lot of time with them.
Yeah.
They were too into their work on mm-hmm. Triacus, and the kids felt like they were neglected.
Yeah.
But at the end, we see the phantom videos that were shot from who knows where by who, but the kids are playing with their parents and everyone's having fun, and it seems almost idyllic except for the horrific rock and desert type landscape they're living in.
Yeah.
But I was kind of scratching my head going, you know, maybe it's just the typical young kid thing and exaggerating, you know, their circumstances to make it seem worse than it was. But
yeah. And you have to wonder how much the influence of Gorgon is in play here.
True. Yeah. He did taint them quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And now Kirk's trying to justify the fact that he actually does like the kids because he invited them aboard his ship and gave them ice cream.
Yeah.
But the kid's kind of calling him out. Yeah. He's like, yeah, you've got your reasons for doing that. I know all about you.
Yeah.
I can see through you, adult.
That's Craig Hunley as Tommy, who goes by his real name of Huxley now. He was born in 1954. And after acting, he's had a really successful career in the music industry.
Really?
for film and TV. Probably most notably or most prolific for the 171 episodes of Walker, Texas Ranger.
Wow.
That he did the music for.
Good God.
Yeah.
That's a lot of music.
Yeah, yeah.
That's great to see these kids go on to other places in the business.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you know, that. Being behind the scenes, and you know, there is life after child acting.
Yeah, yep. At least for these kids, it went on and worked out pretty well.
Yeah. So now we have what? The summoning of Gorgon.
Yeah. How did the kids learn this chant, by the way? If they have to say this to summon that guy.
what would have been the...
It's a chicken and egg thing for me, right? They need the thing to summon him. But I mean, or if he actually showed up to teach them that, then why can't he just show up anytime?
Yeah.
Why do they need to summon him at all? So I wonder what's under that robe. That's a really big robe he's got on. Does he have arms under there? What's he got in? Is he all bloody veins and stuff under there? That was a little Beetlejuice reference there.
So this is Melvin Belli.
It is.
And I got to say, not the best actor.
Yeah, no. No, but I kind of, for some reason, I kind of like him. I don't know why. I know April was pointing this out as a terrible episode in her mind, but I kind of like the way he talks to the kids. It almost seems like... I can't find anything to equate it to, but
like he's reading off a script.
Yeah, it sounds like he's kind of, you know, being very blunt and talking very directly to these kids in a manipulative way. At least it came off not as bad as it did to some other people. But I kind of have a fondness for this.
Yeah, the one thing I thought is possibly he's done this, you know, numerous times, whereas it does sort of feel like a script to him at this point, where this is just the, you know, the talking points he's hit, and he's hit him so many times that it's just become so secondhand for him.
I wonder if this is how he was in the courtroom as a lawyer.
Yes, his primary profession was a lawyer, and they called him the King of Torts.
Yes.
And he, among other clients, Jack Ruby, he was the attorney for Jack Ruby, and he died in 1996 at the age of 88.
Oh, man.
And you said he also was involved with the Rolling Stones after that terrible, terrible tragedy at Altamont.
Yes. Yeah. He was involved in that whole, the whole trial.
Yeah. What did they call that? The death of the 60s?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. I can just imagine at the end of that trial, he turns to the jury and kind of gives them a long, long pause and then exits with, "As you believe, so shall you do." As you believe, so shall you do. And he just let them off. They let everybody off. Like, okay, Belli convinced us. So here's that log entry, by the way. And this guy's using the tricorder the Spock way.
Yeah.
In the background, you see nothing. Yeah. He's not in a tent. He's not in a building. He's not near any structure. He's just kind of out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and you don't even have the purple, the sort of the purple atmosphere that was there when they were down on planet. That looks a little more bluish.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on there. And the lighting is interesting. He's got quite a shadow cast over him.
Yeah, and it's interesting that he opted to do a video log.
Yeah, and who's recording that video log?
Yeah.
So I always wonder, when they have these phantom videos, if someone's standing there with a camera on the planet, like, recording his logs, what does he need the tricorder for? So they felt the same feeling of anxiety that Kirk felt. But Kirk had to go into the cave to feel it.
Yeah.
So I guess the kids must have been messing with the adults mentally. That they didn't have to go into. There's the tricorder peeking up again.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Now he's in front of some rocks. So once again, he doesn't record his logs at home. He likes going out into nature.
I wonder if the tricorder is somehow bouncing off, like it's, you know, a camera technology that we don't understand yet.
Oh, yeah. Perhaps he has got some kind of a drone.
Yeah.
A tricorder drone that kind of floats around. And yeah.
So now we're getting the first indication that the children have some kind of powers.
Now, this is interesting to me because I guess we're supposed to believe that Gorgon bestowed powers upon these kids.
Yeah.
He gave them all the power to do the bonk bonk move and and control the minds of adults.
Yeah, that's one of the questions in this episode that is sort of left up in the air. And it's funny, as we've been working our way through season three here, I really, really, really wished that I had Mark Cushman's third season coverage. Yes. Of, you know, because I want to dig into these episodes and see if some of the questions I have are answered. But that's one of the questions here. I wonder if something was either, you know, jettisoned from the script at some point, or if it truly just isn't explained and we sort of have, you know, you make the assumption that Gorgon, you know, bestowed these kids with these powers.
Yeah. If he did bestow the kids with the powers, doesn't it make sense that he would just be there and do all this stuff himself?
Yeah, you'd think so. If you're going to do mind control, does it matter?
I guess not, but it just seems like he's leaving a lot to chance by having these kids do everything. If he's got the power to do it himself.
Yeah, well, that's the ultimate downfall of most villains.
Yeah, not doing it yourself. Yeah. You know, easily escapable situation and then leaving the room and trusting that everything's going to go according to plan.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So I guess you can just, figure it's laziness on his part that is his ultimate undoing?
Yeah, I just chalked it up to lazy alien. Like, what's he doing now? Why does he have to leave? Why couldn't he just be there all the time? Why do they have to summon him? Why couldn't he just hang around the bridge?
Yeah.
You know, I don't understand what the problem was. I mean, he's got other stuff to do. I mean, he was hanging out in that cave for thousands of years waiting for people to show up. They finally show up, and now he doesn't want to hang out with them.
Yeah. And I like here how Uhura instantly notices that they're out of orbit.
Yeah, and screams it out.
Yeah, and it was one of those things where I was like, wow, you know, so that really shows how everybody on that bridge is acutely aware of what is going on in terms of her primary function isn't to, you know, deal with where and, you know, where the ship's going, but it's something that she's still aware of. And I thought that, of course, here it's sort of a plot convenience that she notices, but I'd like to think that it really shows the attention that everybody on the bridge needs to show.
Yeah, except when somebody yells, we're out of orbit, and the two security guards don't do anything, and the person on the other side of the bridge doesn't even turn her head. Oh, yeah, her just overreacting again. No big deal.
Yeah.
23 so minutes in, and we got our first Scotty appearance.
Yeah, and this is what? This is auxiliary control?
This is auxiliary control.
Yeah, which I know is, it's exciting anytime we can see that.
Yeah, I love the buttons and lights the guy's staring at on the wall there. They just have, like, little codes underneath them. So I guess he knows what all of those buttons do.
Yeah.
But this is great that Scotty can know that they're out of orbit, and he's willing to beat this guy's butt in to make sure they get back on track again. I love it.
Yeah, and it shows a coordinated effort between these kids, because you've got the two kids on the bridge and then this kid down here who is completely acting on the assumption that the kids upstairs, you know, delivered on what they were supposed to do.
Yeah, yeah, I guess so. They don't have any sort of communicators.
Yeah, yeah, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I guess they all have their specific roles to play.
Yeah.
And there it is, the one punch to the back of the head knockout.
Yeah, yeah.
That's so effective.
And I love the coverage of the kid here through the
very, like, ominous.
The great. Yeah, it really is. It's one of the, sort of creepy moments from this episode.
Yeah, and we're finally getting the rest of this log here. So this is another situation where, just like in Star Trek V, some alien entity needs a starship to get off of the planet, right? To get out and control everybody somehow.
What does Melvin Belli need with a starship?
A good one. Good one. You know, it's funny. It's funny that you mentioned that, because the Gorgon, although he didn't make any appearances in any other Trek television shows, he did make a return in a Greg Cox Q Continuum novel. They were Next Generation novels, published around 1998. And in that novel, he's part of a gang of evildoers that also includes the God Imposter from Star Trek V.
Oh, wow.
And the entity from Day of the Dove.
Wow.
So it's very cool that that he got equated to that, and you brought up the what is Melvin Belli needed the starship reference.
That's funny.
Very good. So they do actually meet down the line, and something tells me they probably wanted a starship yet again.
Yes.
Oh, man. Great stuff. So the evil on Triacus, according to Spock's legend, they were marauders and evildoers that were overthrown by the people that they marauded. And the evil sat there and waited and waited for some sort of a catalyst to come back to life, and we find that the kids that were on Triacus are that catalyst. And now evil is spreading and on its way to Marcus 12. And there's nothing that Kirk can do about it.
Yeah. You know what? I'm surprised. You know, they put out a lot of these sort of themed, mini sort of DVD or Blu-ray sets where they just take a handful of episodes and put them out. They call them the best of best of whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'm surprised they never put out like the horror themed one that dealt with, darker, aspects of Star Trek, or the evil forces. I'm thinking of the Wolf in the Fold.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like they could have found, Cat's Paw, a handful of episodes that you put out around Halloween and call it, the Star Trek Fright Pack or something.
Well, there you go. If you're listening, CBS, Paramount, there's an idea for you. Craig will be first in line to purchase that. Great stuff. So this episode is very dialogue heavy.
Yeah.
This is... Kirk has a wooden desk. I'll be damned. And look, he's kind of sloppy. Look at his little monitor back there with all the tapes just kind of thrown underneath there. Kirk's a little bit sloppy in his ready room there.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Very interesting. So he doesn't have somebody to come in and clean that stuff up. Nurse Chapel brings him ice cream that she doesn't come in to clean up his quarters.
Yeah, we've never seen sort of the hospitality services end of Starfleet.
No, once they can Janice Rand, he hasn't had a new yeoman.
And here is just a...
this is sad.
It really is. And it's one of those scenes where a lot of people might watch it and sort of gloss it over. But, I mean, these guys...
Magic.
Yeah. And we also learn that there's limitations to the transporter.
Yeah, that's a weird thing here. That the transporter... It needs coordinates to beam people places.
Yeah, and I love how Spock instantly, Kirk instantly
pushes that idiot out of the way.
Yeah, you know, Kirk's like, Spock, get in there and take care of this.
Yeah. But the coordinates that they beam the guys down to, wouldn't the transporter throw some kind of error saying that, you know, that was out of range or something like that? So they just, it would just beam them into space.
Yeah, you think there would be some kind of safety, the coordinates you entered are not, you know, within range.
Yeah, what if there was like a typo?
Yeah.
I mean, the guy made a typo, like he put in a, you know, a zero where he should have put in an eight or something, and it's completely wrong coordinates.
But you know what? This is the same starship that has the jettison pod button.
Oh, yeah, that's true. They just jettisoned the crewman.
And there was no court-martial for this.
No, not at all. Like, oops. Doesn't Kirk have to log the fact that they beamed the guys into space and killed them?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
What a terrible way to go, though.
Oof, God. Well, you know, this episode, speaking, you know, I said prior to this that the Paradise Syndrome was one of the darkest episodes of Trek for me, where the baby and the mother of Kirk's child both die.
Yeah.
At the end of the episode. This episode is also pretty dark as well. I mean, all these kids are now orphans.
Yeah.
Their parents are dead. All of them. I mean, that's what, there's five kids. That's 10 people, right?
Yeah.
10 parents dead. And, you know, it's like, okay, you know, they kind of, they talk about it, but it almost feels like an afterthought at the end of the episode, because they are leaving off with the fact that they're just dropping these kids at a starbase.
Yeah.
Like, all right, your parents are dead here. Go to the starbase. That's a shame. That's pretty dark. And here's our man, Belli, again.
Yeah, we've got the reveal now.
Yes, they've got the reveal that the Gorgon is attempting to take control of the Enterprise, that they can spread all over the universe. And anybody who... And look, the kids are like entranced by him. But anybody who gets in their way will be dispatched. And anybody who doesn't get in their way is their friend. And it's going to be part of... their merry band of marauders who are controlling the universe for who knows what purpose.
Yeah.
You know, what is Gorgon going to do? I mean, he can't even bear to stay here on the Enterprise for 5 minutes. I mean, what's he going to do when he controls everything? it almost seems aimless, pointless. Yeah. He's just controlling stuff just to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you would think most villains have some sort of an end goal.
Yeah.
You know, they want to, you know, Lex Luthor wants to, you know, blow up California so that he can have prime real estate on the new coast, right? It's greed. Yeah. It's money. What is Gorgon's end goal?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he looks like he's like an apparition.
Yeah.
You know, what is riches and power do for him?
I think he just wants everybody to be unhappy.
Oh.
He's one of those guys that, you know, every day's a rainy day for him. And he hates seeing people have sunny days.
He wants to terrify Sulu with images of daggers and swords. And terrify poor Uhura with visions of her old self.
Yeah.
Crippled. All right.
Oh, and here it comes. Is this the first indication that there's a mirror?
There was never a mirror there. It's taped there. You can see it's kind of just taped over the piece of the console. I love it. So now you... No, I don't know. I'm not going to tear it apart too much, but it just seems like after all the crap that these people have been through, all the crazy, ridiculous things, that they would be able to look at this and go, okay, obviously something's going on here. I'm being manipulated. I'm seeing things that aren't really here. I mean, they've seen so many godlike creatures and aliens that make them do things. You would think they have so much experience that they'd be immune to this kind of stuff.
Especially after they see an apparition on the bridge.
Yes, yeah, they see this dude, you know, floating there with these giant robes, and all of a sudden, you know, he leaves and everything's back to normal and everything is believable. Like, is that actually Nichelle Nichols with makeup on?
It looks like it to me.
Sure does. Wow. That's pretty creepy looking.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
So pretty cool, you get to learn what some of the main characters' fears are. Sulu's obviously afraid of swords and daggers. Uhura's afraid of getting old. And we're going to learn that once again, we already knew this, but we're going to learn that Kirk is afraid of losing command.
Yeah.
Mm. I love that Shatner's getting physical with he gets physical with Uhura and then gets physical with Sulu. I wonder if he enjoyed this. If Shatner enjoyed doing these scenes.
I'm sure he enjoyed it more than George.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
So now we have a shocking moment here where Spock has been sort of hypnotized by the forces on the ship.
Yeah, but not in the same way the other crew members were.
Yeah, they're not trying to do any mind tricks with him in terms of tricking him into seeing one thing when he's seeing something else. It's just here,
to make him lackadaisical.
Yeah, and I love this is an angle of a control panel. We've never really seen, that much detail before.
Yeah, you're getting to see all the way down the wall there.
That whole side of, Spock's sort of area.
And that's a handheld shot, it looks like.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of warble in the camera there. It looks like they got a handheld shot. So they're doing things in the third season camera-wise that they didn't do in the previous two, for the most part.
Mm-hmm. And that might have been just, working within budget. You say, we don't have time to set up the shot. Just get the handheld and bust it out. But it's great in the sense that it showcases the amount of detail that they had on this bridge, even if you never really see it.
True. There's a lot of stuff there that's minutia. And, thankfully for the Blu-ray, we can detect a lot of these differences and these details. So we're getting reversed Shatner dialogue here.
Yeah.
And I happen to have the actual dialogue, if you're interested in hearing it.
I'm very interested.
All right. So if you were to play this scene in reverse, what Shatner is saying to the security guard is, "Remove Lieutenant Uhura and Mr. Spock from the bridge. Confine them to quarters. Did you hear me? Take Sulu to his quarters. He's relieved of duty. Remove Lieutenant Uhura and Mr. Spock from the bridge. Confine them to quarters. Take Mr. Sulu to his quarters, I said. Mr. Spock from the bridge. Confine him to quarters. Mr. Leslie, take Mr. Sulu to his quarters. He's relieved of duty." So it's it's pretty much a rant.
Yeah.
He says the same things multiple times. But I love the fact that we had reverse dialogue.
Yeah.
It must have been such a mystery when you were watching this episode the first time, knowing that it's actually Shatner talking. But back then you had no way of knowing what he was saying because you couldn't record it and play it backwards.
Yeah.
Could you? So
here's the "I have to take a leak."
Oh, I love that. And this is one of the moments, I think, in Trek that people who criticize Shatner are right on about. Yeah. I mean, this is his overacting at the best.
Yeah.
This scene here and when they get in the turbo lift. So once again, his greatest fear in the universe is losing command of the Enterprise. So I get this is almost like Kirk as an egomaniac, right? The ship is sailing on and he doesn't have command. He's all alone.
Yeah.
So if he's not in control of the Enterprise, that's his worst fear.
Right.
I don't know if I like that, but I guess we have to go with it because it's what's been committed to film.
Mm-hmm.
But
and we get Spock's use of just the word "Jim" here, which is always great when you hear Spock use that because it really indicates the level of friendship between the two of them, that Spock's able to utilize that in situations where, Captain Kirk really needs to sort of be centered.
Yeah, that's the reset button.
Yeah.
That's Kirk's reset. You just call him Jim, and it snaps him out of it.
Every time Spock uses it, it's effective. More so than the way it affects Kirk, but also I think as a viewer, for me at least, every one of those moments carry weight for me.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? It's like when you were a little kid and your parents used your middle name.
Yes.
You're like, "Oh man, I know I'm in trouble now." If my mom would just yell my name at me, it was like, "Yeah, whatever, Ma." But if she threw in the middle name, I knew she was serious.
Yeah.
So, I love how Scotty is just, he's so brainwashed now that he's going to threaten to kill Kirk and Spock.
Yeah, I'd have to kill you.
I'll have to kill you. And this is great. Scotty wants to kill him, and so does Chekhov in a minute.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, I guess the mind control is really powerful.
Oh, yeah.
Because we've seen how loyal these guys are to Kirk and Spock all the way through this series. And now we get, you know, a little bit of mind control. It's all it takes to turn them into murderous, you know, crew members who would rather, you know, give into this mind control than trust their loyalty. And, you know, this would have been a great scene for Spock to just do a few nerve pinches and take over auxiliary control.
Yeah. Well, we will see him use the nerve pinch in a couple minutes.
Yeah, just one though.
Yeah.
He could have done like a double nerve pinch there and got two guys at once.
Yeah. Well, you still had a pretty, you know, boss moment for Kirk and Spock there where they threw off the three guys. You know, it was almost like a superhero moment where, you know, you have the gang of people on top of one guy and he sort of lunges up and they fly off.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Now I have a question for you.
Sure, I love questions.
Now, wouldn't this be the perfect time for Kirk and Spock to just kind of saunter down into the transporter room and just direct beam all these kids right into the brig? Problem solved. Done. I mean, why are they messing around with all this? You just go down there and just beam them directly in. That would have been perfect. I don't know. I guess it seems like they just forget the most convenient solutions to some of these problems.
Yeah.
And here we go. This is almost like a mirror universe scene, isn't it?
I was totally going to say that. That's totally what I felt in this scene. It was like we were looking at mirror Chekhov.
And he's got his two thugs with him. Two unnamed red shirt guys who have unbreakable stares. You know, their gazes are unwavering.
Yeah.
So, and I love how Spock just kind of stands idly by and listens to this whole thing. When he could just totally just drop those guys right now, just nerve pinch, nerve pinch, and nerve pinch. I mean, it would have been completely done. Oh, and Chekhov pulls out the phaser.
Yeah, it just got real.
Yeah, man. And the kids bonk bonking in the background there. You know, do all kids in the Star Trek universe know that bonk bonk maneuver?
I guess. That must be big in the future.
I guess so. My God. There it is again. It's great. I mean, these could have been the exact same kids from Miri.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, we're going to get a little scuffle scene here. Another little fight scene. And Chekhov says he never disobeyed an order before. I've got to go back and watch the second season again and see if that's true.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if that's true.
And I love how Spock was like, I've had enough of this.
Yeah, done. And it's funny that Spock doesn't resort to the nerve pinch immediately.
Yeah.
He actually does get into a little physical altercation with this guy before. And then he had to turn him around to the right position so he was facing the camera.
Yeah.
And Shatner finishes off his guy at the same time. Yeah. Good stuff. Yeah, and the kid runs away. And it's interesting that the kid can't control Kirk and Spock anymore.
Yeah, you know, that is.
You know, Kirk says he's fought off his beast. And I guess Spock still doesn't have a beast? But he was controlled on the bridge a few minutes ago. You know, I love how the kid's sitting in Kirk's chair.
Oh, yeah.
That's a great scene. He's actually in command of this ship.
Yeah. And we've got Eddie Paskey there as Hadley in Chekhov's seat.
I love how Kirk uses psychology here. He uses his mental power, again, his smarts, to win the day. And he doesn't resort to violence to win. You know, he doesn't blow up Gorgon. He doesn't shoot the kids or vaporize the kids or have Spock nerve pinch the kids. Like, he actually talks his way out of the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's great. So Kirk not only can talk computers to death, he can talk alien apparitions to death as well.
Yeah. So the little girl here is Mary, played by Pamela Lynn Ferdin, born in 1959. And the next year, she would provide the voice of Lucy in A Boy Named Charlie Brown.
No way.
And she now is working as an animal activist.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Well, you know, I love the Peanuts, so that's a great connection. Great connection. And I love the fact that they were taping the kids singing earlier. Oh, and yeah. And can play it right back. And they have the Spock's got the tape right there.
Yeah.
And Gorgon can be fooled.
Yeah, I was going to say, they don't need to do the whole, you know, hand-holding and, you know, circular dance.
Yeah, I love how they turn it into a game. Mm-hmm. They do like a ring around the Rosie kind of thing with it. But I like how Gorgon can just totally be fooled. And the chant summons the rest of the kids, too.
Yeah.
It's very effective. Very, very effective. And you know, this is funny. No one ever told Kirk Gorgon's name, but he knows it.
Ah, good point.
Isn't that interesting that he, you never even really hear it until now.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden it's Kirk just happens to know the name. So that kind of makes you wonder if there were some deleted bits out of the script where it was revealed earlier on. Yeah. Supposedly there was a deleted scene where Tommy, the redheaded kid, told Kirk the name, but that scene supposedly took place after this in the script. So leads me to believe there must have been something earlier on in the script that revealed the alien's name.
Right.
So we're going to get some dialogue exchange here. That, you know, and I really like that Gorgon refers to the kids as his future generals.
Yeah.
So he's building some sort of an army.
Right.
And these kids are going to be his military. But again, I think this would have been much more effective if he had some sort of an end goal that he stated. You know, it just seems like, you know, he's going to Marcus 12. He knows what Marcus 12 is, obviously. And he knows that there's people, millions of people on Marcus 12. How does he know that? I don't know. But he knows it's a good target to build his army.
Yeah.
And it just seems weird that he wants to build some sort of a military and just, I guess, rule for the sake of ruling.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Just kind of weird to me. But at any rate.
So now we're going to get the footage of the kids in happier times.
Yeah, more phantom video recordings, by the way. It just seems like so many video recordings in this show are made by just phantom cameras being placed places.
Yeah, it reminds me of all the cameras that were on the Enterprise for the menagerie.
Yeah, exactly right.
And now we see that the parents were, in fact, pretty actively involved in, you know, playing and interacting with their kids.
Yep, and there's a little tent or whatever that is, a little pop-up structure there in the background. At least, so we knew they had some sort. They weren't all sleeping out under the stars every night.
Yeah.
You know, now, wow, how crazy would it have been if those ear-burrowing creatures were living in the sand on that planet, the ones from Star Trek II?
Oh, wow.
You know, they're sleeping on this planet out there playing in this dirt. I mean, who knows what kind of alien monsters are down there?
Yeah.
That's kind of a questionable parenting in my mind. Taking your children to this barren sand heap to utilize the words of Khan.
Ooh, and now here's some tough truths being shown to these kids.
Okay. I just noticed it. Look, it looks like they burned out the shelters in the background. Because there was smoke coming out of some rubble.
Yeah, so they... I do know when they beamed down, there was smoke on the planet.
And maybe the kids torched it all.
Oof.
Mm, that makes it even worse. Wow. That's tough.
Yeah. And now you can only imagine what places the kids had to go in their heads to get to this, you know, this emotional level of crying. And you got to wonder what the director might have said to them.
Yeah, I wonder if those were actually real tears or they just put some, you know, some water or whatever on their faces to make it look like they were crying. Because it looks like almost real tears, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the little girl, especially, looks like she might have rubbed her eyes a lot.
Yeah, I think the little girl might actually be crying. Yeah, I don't think that kid's crying.
Yeah,
I don't think any of the other kids are really crying.
Well, haven't they said that if the tears come out of the inside, they're real tears, and on the outside, they're sort of stage tears.
I never thought about that. I never heard that before.
Yeah, I'll have to look that up. I thought I read that somewhere where the tear falls actually is, you know, your tear duct is you know, in a particular place.
Yes, it is right by your, it's in the corner near your nose, right?
Yeah.
So, uh-oh.
Yeah, now we're starting to see Gorgon's armor is starting to be broken down.
Yeah, poor Melvin Belli had to have all his makeup and crap put on his face. Ooh, that's pretty gruesome looking.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's any pictures of him without the the transparency effect, so you can actually see what he really looked like.
I assume or hope that in These Are the Voyages Season 3, we are going to get some nice on-set photography.
Man, God. That's pretty rough looking.
Yeah, and
he's still got his flowery dress on.
Yeah.
Death to you all as he fades away. But unfortunately, it's just the parents and the two red shirt guys that got beamed into the middle of space who experienced the death. So the rest of them get to live.
Yep. And Uhura's happy now that she's young again.
Hey, look, and McCoy showed back up again. Yeah, where's he been?
Like, hey, guys, what's going on?
Hey. I was down watching a movie. What happened?
And he's happy to see the kids crying. He understands now that they've processed their grief or started to acknowledge it.
Psychologist McCoy on the case. On the case. Now, this would have been a job for Counselor Troy if this was a next-gen episode, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, see, maybe they could have used a psychologist on the Enterprise. But I guess we are at the point once again where we must issue our essential votes.
Yep. You want to go?
Yeah, sure. Why not? Very easy one. Non-essential. There's really nothing, and nothing upon nothing. I think there's really no memorable character moments. There's, you know, nothing new that we're introduced to, except for the atrium, which was kind of neat, and the cave set, but those aren't necessarily something that you don't see later, as we mentioned. You will see them both in other episodes, so... I don't think this episode is as horrible as some people say. I mean, I know there's a couple websites that list this as the worst. Yeah. I don't think it's the worst, but it isn't the greatest, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, you know what? But sort of like Spock's brain, at least it carries your attention. It's not boring.
No. There are some parts that drag, but it's not the most boring of episodes by a long shot.
Yeah. So I will also go non-essential here. And, you know, you could say, or I guess you could argue that maybe showing the limitations of the transporter, you know, could be factored in. Or even the debut of the United Federation of Planets flag, which really doesn't really amount to much because that flag design will change over time. So neither one of those really factor my decision here. Yeah, I agree with you here. There's nothing on display that makes this essential.
All right. So double non-essential for And the Children Shall Lead, and we will be back next week with Is There in Truth No Beauty?
Yep, right on.
All right. So catch up with us on social media, facebook.com/thetricordertransmissions, TTT_pod on Twitter. And we also have our own forums on our website, thetricordertransmissions.com. And we have a new Star Trek, the original series area on the new Facebook Rooms platform. If you're on an iPhone, you can download that app for free and join up with our conversation on that site as
well.
Very
cool.
All right. Anything else from you, Craig, before we sign off?
Nope. I guess I'll see you next Sunday.
All right. Take it easy, everybody.
The wolf shall also dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. That's from the Bible, Isaiah 11:6 to be exact. And it's where we get the title of this Star Trek story, And the Children Shall Lead. It is, as we'll discover, a sarcastic title because the children we're about to meet have lost touch with their own horrifying reality. The only direction in which these children could lead would have tragic consequences for those who might follow. For the children and for the audience as well, things are not what they appear to be.
Once again, an evil entity has been vanquished. The Gorgon follows a long list of evil entities who've met their collective fates at the hands of the Enterprise crew. Consider some of Star Trek's more intriguing villains, the Probe, Nomad and the Changeling, an ancient evil force named Red Jack that was once called Jack the Ripper and Wolf in the Fold, and an all-powerful being with a sense of humor known as Trelane in The Squire of Gothos. If, as someone once said, the measure of a man may be taken by the stature of his enemies, then surely Kirk and company are most formidable.
We live in an age where we are bombarded with images and influences. Every time we turn on the TV, flip through a magazine, or listen to the radio, we're told what to do, what to buy, where to go, what to think. As adults, we're usually able to filter these influences and decide for ourselves which are valid and which are not. Children, on the other hand, have not yet developed this crucial ability. In the end, And the Children Shall Lead is a lesson to us all that our children are susceptible to all kinds of outside influences, both good and bad.